Chapter 57. The gracefully curved serpent head, intricately carved with mouth agape, stared sightlessly at the water flowing into the cavern, as if searching for a distant shore. On an enormous ledge 4 feet above the water's edge, 6 open wooden boats, held upright by their keels and wedged by wooden cradles, sat side by side, stern to bow. The serpent rose on the bow post of the largest boat nearest the rim of the ledge. The boats were built entirely of oak, the largest stretching more than 60 feet in length. The sun's reflection coming through the water in the tunnel cast feathery ribbons of light against the elegantly shaped hulls. From their view in the water, the divers could look up at the keels and the broad, symmetrically arched hulls with their clinker-built, overlapping strake planking that was still held together with rusting iron rivets. Below the rack where shields had once been stored, oars still protruded through small, round ports. Now gripped by ghostly hands, they seemed poised, waiting for a command to row. It seemed inconceivable that such aesthetically elegant hull lines could have been designed and built 1,000 years in the past. "They're Viking," Kelly murmured in astonished awe. "They've been here all the time, and nobody knew." "Your father knew," said Pitt. "He knew from the Viking inscriptions that they had settled on the palisades above the Hudson River, which led him to the discovery of the tunnel leading down to the cavern from above." "They're well preserved," Giordino observed, casting an admiring eye over the Viking ships. "Despite the dampness, I see little signs of rot." Pitt pointed up at the masts that were still standing with their furled red and white coarse woolen sails, then at the vaulted roof of the cavern high above their heads. "They left them stepped because of the cavern's lofty ceiling." "They look as if all you had to do is drop them in the water, raise the sails, and go," Kelly whispered in breathless wonder. "Let's take a closer look," Pitt said. After removing their fins, face masks, and weight belts, they climbed a rock-chiseled stairway to the top of the ledge and mounted the boarding ramps that ran from the rock to the upper strake of the largest ship. The ramps were sound and obviously put there by Dr. Egan. The light inside the cavern was dim, but they recognized the objects scattered on the floorboards. What looked like a body was wrapped in a burial shroud. On each side were smaller bundles in burial shrouds. Around the bodies, a treasure trove of artifacts had been literally dumped in scattered disarray. There were gilt, bronzed figures of saints, a stack of illuminated manuscripts in Gospel Latin, and reliquary boxes filled with coins and silver chalices, most likely all stolen from monasteries during raids on England and Ireland. Amber necklaces, gold and silver brooches, elaborate silver and bronze necklaces and bracelets lay in piles inside elaborately carved wooden boxes. Bronze dishes and incense burners from the Orient, along with furniture, textiles, and linen, and a beautifully carved sled for the chief to be towed on in winter snow, were also lying about. "My guess is this is Bjarn Sigvitsson," said Pitt. Kelly looked sadly at the 2 smaller bundles. "They must be his children." "He must have been quite a warrior to have accumulated this much wealth," Giordino muttered, gazing raptly at the treasures. "From reading Dad's research notebooks," said Kelly, "I had the impression important chieftains were sent to Valhalla after a glorious death, along with all their worldly goods and chattels, which included their horses, other animals, and their servants. He should also have his battle axe, sword, and shield. I see none of these." "The burial was a rush job," agreed Giordino. Pitt motioned toward the boarding ramp. "Let's have a look at the other boats." To Kelly's horror, the adjacent boats were strewn with bones intermingled with broken and shattered household goods. Few skeletons were intact. Most looked as though they had been hacked to pieces. Pitt knelt and studied a skull with a jagged gash in the top of the cranium. There must have been a terrible massacre. Could they have fought among themselves? I don't think so, said Giordino. He removed an arrow that was embedded between the ribs of one pile of bones and held it up. This says Indians. The sagas suggested that Sigvatsson and his people sailed away from Greenland and were never heard of again, said Pitt, trying to imagine a face on the skull. It also lends credibility to the legend Dr. Wednesday told of the Indians slaughtering all the Vikings in the settlement. This proves it was no myth, Giordino said quietly. Kelly looked at Pitt. Then the Norse settlement? Was located on your father's farm, Pitt finished. He found artifacts and was influenced to launch his research project. Kelly wrung her hands mournfully. But why did he keep it a secret? Why didn't he call in archaeologists to conduct excavations? Why not show the world that Vikings had arrived in what is now New York and begun a colony? Your father was a brilliant man, said Giordino. In his mind, he must have had a good reason for the secrecy. He definitely didn't want an army of archaeologists and reporters invading his privacy during his experiments. 30 minutes later, while Kelly and Giordino examined the rest of the Vikings' ships, not an easy undertaking in the dim light of the cavern, Pitt began wandering around the ledge. In the gloom, he spotted a stairway hacked into the rock that led up into a tunnel. He climbed the first 4 steps with his hand, trailing along one wall for support, when his fingers met with something that felt like an electrical switch. He touched it lightly and determined that the lever swung clockwise. Curious, he turned the lever until it clicked. Suddenly, the entire cavern was illuminated by bright fluorescent lights set into the rock walls. Cool, Kelly uttered in surprise. Now we can see what we're doing. Pitt walked over to where she and Giordino were searching through one of the boats. I know another reason why your father kept this place a secret, he said slowly, deliberately. Kelly seemed only mildly interested, but Giordino stared at him. He'd known Pitt too long not to recognize when he was about to spring a revelation. And he saw the direction in which Pitt's eyes were aimed, and he turned and did the same. A long, cylindrical iron vessel was moored to a dock along the far side of the cavern. The hull was covered with a thin coating of rust. The only noticeable protrusion was a small hatch tower set several feet aft of the forward bow. The vessel had not been visible in the darkened cavern interior until Pitt had turned on the lights. What in God's name is that? Kelly muttered. That, said Pitt with a note of triumph in his voice, is the Nautilus. Their astonishment at standing on a dock that had been built by Dr. Elmore Egan and staring down at the legendary and fabled submarine was equal to what they'd felt with the discovery of the Viking ships. To suddenly find a marvel of 19th-century engineering that everybody had thought was fiction was like a dream turned real. At the foot of the dock, rising along the rim of the rock ledge, was a pile of stones stacked in the shape of a sarcophagus. A wooden plaque with carved letters revealed it as the final resting place of the submarine's creator. Here lie the mortal remains of Captain Cameron Amherst, made famous by the writings of Jules Verne as the immortal Captain Nemo. May those who someday discover his tomb honor him with the respect he deserves. My esteem of your father continues to grow, Pitt said to Kelly. He was a man to envy. Knowing Dad built this monument with his own hands makes me proud. Giordino, who'd lagged behind after exploring a side cave, approached the dock. I found another answer to the mystery that had been bothering me. Pitt looked at him. Which mystery? If Dr. Egan had a hidden laboratory, where was the source of his electrical energy? I found it in a side cave. There are three portable generating units in there connected to enough batteries to power a small town. He pointed down at the dock and the series of electrical cables running along the edge and through the hatch of the submarine. 10 to 1, he used the interior for his laboratory. Now that I see the Nautilus close up, said Kelly, it's much bigger than I imagined. She hardly looks like the Disney version, Giordino mused. Her outer hull is simple and functional. Pitt nodded in agreement. The top of the hull rose but 3 feet from the water, giving a bare hint of her mass beneath. I estimate her length at about 250 feet, with a 25-foot beam larger than Verne described. She's close to the dimensions of the first Navy submarine with advanced hydrodynamic design that was launched in 1953. The Albacore, replied Giordino. I saw her sailing down the York River about 10 years ago. You're right, there is a resemblance. Giordino walked over to an electrical panel mounted above the dock beside a gangplank leading to the submarine's deck next to the hatch tower. He pressed a pair of switches. The interior of the vessel was instantly bathed in light that beamed up through a series of ports along the roof and through larger viewports seen below in the water. Pitt turned to Kelly and motioned down the open hatch tower. Ladies first. She placed her hands against her chest as if to slow her pounding heart. She wanted to see where her father had worked all those years, to see the inside of the famous vessel, but she found it difficult to take the first step. It seemed to her that she was entering a house of ghosts. Finally, with great force of will, she entered the hatch and climbed down the ladder. The entry compartment was small. She waited until Pitt and Giordino joined her. In front of them was a door that looked like it belonged on a house more than in a submarine. Pitt turned the latch, opened it, and stepped over the threshold. Silently, they walked through an ornately furnished dining hall, 15 feet in length, centered on a teak wood table for 10, with beautifully carved standing dolphins for legs. At the far end was another door that led into a library, whose shelves, Pitt guessed, contained more than 5,000 books. He studied the titles on the spines. One side held books on engineering and science. The opposite shelves were stacked with original editions of the classics. He picked one that had been written by Jules Verne and opened it. The title page had been inscribed by Verne to "The Greatest Mind in the Universe." He slipped it back carefully in its place on the shelf and continued the exploration. The next compartment was quite large, stretching more than 30 feet. This area, Pitt was certain, was the grand saloon that Verne had described as filled with art treasures and ancient artifacts Cameron had gleaned from under the sea. But the saloon was no longer a museum and gallery. Elmore Egan had transformed it into a workshop and a chemistry laboratory. The room, 12 feet wide, was filled with counters holding a maze of chemical lab apparatus. A spacious workshop with compact machinery, including a lathe and a drill press, and 3 different computer stations with an array of printers and scanners. Only the organ was still there, having been too massive for Elmore to move. The instrument on which Amherst had played works from the great composers was a masterpiece of craftsmanship, with beautifully finished wood and brass pipes. Kelly walked over to the counter littered with chemistry equipment and tenderly touched the beakers and test tubes lying about in disorder, assembling and stacking them neatly in racks and on shelves. She lingered in the laboratory, soaking up her father's presence while Pitt and Giordino moved on, passing through a long corridor and into a watertight bulkhead before entering the next compartment. This section of the Nautilus had once served as Captain Amherst's private cabin. Egan had converted it into his think tank. Plans, blueprints, and drawings, along with 100 notebooks, were stacked in every square inch of space around a large drafting table where Egan had worked out his designs. "So this is where one great man lived and another great man created," Giordino commented philosophically. "Let's keep going," said Pitt. "I want to see where he built his teleportation sending chamber." They walked through another watertight bulkhead and into a compartment that had once held the submarine's air tanks. These had been removed by Egan to make room for his teleportation instruments and equipment. There were two panels with dials and switches, a computer desk, and an enclosed chamber that contained the sending station. Pitt smiled when he saw a 55-gallon drum marked Super Slick sitting in the chamber. It was connected to a timing device and a series of tubes, which were themselves connected to a round receptacle on the floor. "Now we know where the oil comes from that keeps filling up Egan's leather case." "I wonder how it all works," said Giordino, examining the sending station. "It will take someone smarter than me to figure it out. It's amazing that it actually works. As crude and elementary as it appears, you're looking at a scientific achievement that will forever alter the transportation of the future." Pitt stepped over to the instrument panel where the timing device was mounted. He saw that the sequence was set at 14 hours. He reset it to 10. "What are you doing?" asked Giordino curiously. The edges of his lips lifted in a sneaky grin. "I'm sending a message to Hiram Yeager and Max." Having gone as far as they could go toward the bow, Pitt and Giordino retraced their steps to the main saloon. Kelly was sitting in a chair, looking for all the world as if she were in the midst of an out-of-body experience. Pitt squeezed her shoulder tenderly. "We're heading toward the engine room. Would you like to come along?" She brushed her cheek against his hand. "Did you find anything interesting?" "Your father's teleportation compartment." "Then he actually created and built a device that can send objects through space?" "He did." Lost in euphoria, she rose from the chair and quietly followed the two men as they made their way aft. Once on the other side of the dining hall in the entry compartment, they passed through a galley that made Kelly cringe. Food containers were cluttered around the countertops. Dirty dishes and utensils were green with mold in a large sink, and large baskets of trash and garbage and plastic bags were stacked in a heap in one corner of the galley. "Your father had many qualities," observed Pitt, "but neatness wasn't one of them." "He had other things on his mind," Kelly said lovingly. "It's a pity he didn't take me into his confidence. I could have acted as his secretary and housekeeper." They went through the next opening into the crew's quarters. What they saw there was the most mind-boggling of all. Here is where Elmore had stored the treasures that had once adorned the main saloon and library. The number of canvases would have filled two rooms of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Leonardo da Vinci, Titian, Raphael, Rembrandt, Vermeer, Rubens, and 30 others were stacked in rows. Sculptures from antiquity, in bronze and marble, stood in closets and individual crews' cabins. And then there were the treasures that Amherst had salvaged from ancient shipwrecks. Piles of gold and silver bars, boxes filled to overflowing with coins and gemstones. The value of the collection was beyond their comprehension, beyond their wildest appraisal. "I feel like Ali Baba after he discovered the 40 Thieves' Cave of Riches," said Pitt in a hushed voice. Kelly was equally astounded. "I never dreamed anything like this existed. Giordino took a handful of gold coins and let them sift through his fingers. If there was ever a question as to how Dr. Elmore financed his experiments, what we see here tells it all. They spent nearly an hour combing through the great hoard before carrying on with their tour. After walking through another watertight bulkhead, they found themselves in the Nautilus's engine room. This was the most expansive section of the ship, measuring 60 feet in length by 20 feet in width. The maze of pipes, tanks, and strange-looking mechanisms that Pitt and Giordino recognized as electrical generating equipment had to be a plumber's nightmare. A huge gear system with meshing steel teeth dominated the aft end of the room. While Kelly wandered about, not nearly as fascinated by the machinery as the men, she came to a high podium-like table without a chair that held a large leather-bound book. She opened it and studied the old-fashioned scroll handwriting in brown ink. The book proved to be the chief engineer's log. The last entry was dated June 10th, 1901, and read, "Closed down the engine for the final time. We'll keep the generators operating for power until my demise. The Nautilus that has served me so faithfully for 40 years will now serve as my tomb. This is my last entry." It was signed Cameron Amherst. Meanwhile, Pitt and Giordino were poring over the massive engine with its distinctive 19th century fittings, valves, and unfamiliar mechanisms, many of them cast and polished in brass. Pitt crawled under and around the great engine, inspecting it from every angle. Finally, he stood and scratched the stubble on his chin. "I've researched hundreds of marine engines in hundreds of different ships, including old steamships, but I've never seen anything that matches this layout." Giordino, who had been examining the manufacturer's plaques bolted on different parts of the machinery, said, "The power plant did not come from one manufacturer. Amherst must have commissioned 30 different marine engine machinists throughout Europe and America to build this thing before assembling it with his own crew." "That's how he managed to construct the Nautilus in secrecy. What do you make of the design?" "My best guess is that it's a combination of massive electrical energy and a rudimentary form of magnetohydrodynamics." "So Amherst created the concept 140 years before it was rediscovered. He didn't have the technology to run the seawater through a magnetic core kept at absolute zero by liquid helium. That wouldn't be produced commercially for another 60 years. So he used a kind of sodium converter. It wasn't nearly as efficient, but good enough for his purposes. Amherst had to compensate by relying on massive electrical energy to produce enough generating current to turn the propeller at an efficient rate of speed." "Then it would seem likely that Egan used Amherst's engine as a base for his own designs. It must have proven an inspiration for him." "A phenomenal piece of work," said Giordino, appreciating the ingenuity behind the huge engine. "Especially when you realize that it propelled the Nautilus into every corner of the undersea world for 40 years. Kelly approached, carrying the engine room log. She looked as if she were staring at a ghost. "If we're finished in here for now, I'd like to find the passage Dad must have discovered to get back and forth between here and the house above." Pitt nodded and glanced at Giordino. "We should contact the Admiral and report what we've found here." "I'm sure he'd like to know," Giordino agreed. 5 minutes, no more, was all it took to climb through the passage leading up to the top of the Palisades. Pitt felt a strange sensation, knowing the Vikings had passed this same way 1,000 years earlier. He could almost hear their voices and touch their presence. Josh Thomas was sitting in Egan's study, reading a chemical analysis journal, when he froze in fright. The rug in the center of the room suddenly rose from the floor as if a ghost were inside and then flew aside. A trap door beneath swung open and Pitt's head popped up like a jack-in-the-box. "Sorry to intrude," said Pitt with a cheery smile, "but I just happened to be passing by."